Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, going right into the show tonight, July 21st, 2011. And many topics to cover tonight. First of all, about a week ago, Pastor Peters of Scriptures for America passed away, and I don't have a lot of details other than he was ill, had been ill for some time, a short time, generally a very healthy person, but died of a natural causes. So I just wanted to say that over the many, many years I'd been a guest on his show, Pastor Peters, my show, of course, airs also on his network on Friday evening, Saturday morning. So just a note here. I want to recount that the last interview I did with Pastor Peters was an interview where I talked probably for about half an hour about the prime numbers being used for the planning of events and numerology with secret societies. And the secret societies that basically centered around the banking systems of the world. This is a very complicated topic, but something I began to notice that, and we all know that these numbers that, as far as dates are concerned, when events, planned events occurred, whether it was the Japanese alleged earthquake, tsunami on March 11th or September 11th, 2001, these dates are chosen through numerology. And many times, whether it's a bank failure or a stock market failure, these dates are planned far in advance. So what I began to analyze is the relationship between dates, and there's a definite relationship between many of the dates when things happen in this world, planned events, so to speak. But that was my last interview with Pastor Peters. So anyway, a tribute to Pastor Peters. Hopefully be able to talk a little bit more in the future about some of my experiences with him. But let me just say this. We live in a very complex world today. And Pastor Peters had an unusually good understanding of what's going on in the world today and was not afraid to speak about it. So given that, I know the work that he was doing will continue, and so will be missed. A person that, as I said, understood what was going on in the world today and wasn't afraid to talk about it. Okay, so on with tonight's show. I want to first give you information. If you have a feeling that your bank is about ready to fail, I'm going to give you a website to go and check it out, see if your bank is on the ready to fail list. It's called this is fairly easy to remember, so you don't have to write it down, Money and Markets, and is spelt out, A-N-D. So it's www.moneyandmarkets, markets is plural, .com. And on that webpage you can find the list of banks that are about to fail. Such a strange phenomenon in a country where there shouldn't be any of this. Bank failure should not be even an issue. Why do we have the whole banking situation is very complicated, but why do we have banks failing in a country where we should have all the wealth in the world? But, okay, so anyway, if you are worried about a local bank going under, look at moneyandmarkets.com. I want to also mention, this came in from a listener. I wanted to pass it on. Many people today want to know where their products are made. So where was, if you bought something, whether it was a light switch that you're going to replace in your house, whether it's a product of food, where did this come from? Many times the manufacturers or distributors get around telling you where it came from by placing deceptive labeling, like distributed from so-and-so, and then it gives a city, USA, and that would make you think that, this is a product from the United States. Or it might say assembled in the United States. It could say many different deceptive phrases. But, as I found out, somebody, a listener, sent this in. If you want to know where the product was actually manufactured, look on the label, and there is a code, the barcode. If it starts with 69, then it's made in China. If it's made, if the barcode number begins with 00 to 09, then it's the USA or Canada. And then there's other barcodes, 30 to 37, it says, was made in France. But if the barcode on the product states, if the number of the barcode begins with 690, 691, or 692, then it's made in China. So just take the package, you know where the barcode is, where the automatic reader at the register, when you take it to the register, that little barcode where they scan to determine the price and the product, that if that number on that barcode begins with 690, 691, or 692, the product is made in China. So that's something to watch out for. Also, about just, I know everybody's concerned about the nuclear issue, and it's something I've stated before. As with all of the industries, the nuclear industry runs Washington in terms of nuclear power. The oil industry runs Washington. The pharmaceutical industry runs Washington, and on and on. So when it comes to your safety, the industry really runs the show. So here I picked up a Wall Street Journal the other day, and by the way, I did a little tour of our country this week, and I'll be talking about that. Mainly through the states of Nebraska, the Dakotas, the big crop-growing states. And I looked around to see what I could see in terms of flooding, in terms of drought. And we have a very unusual condition where many of these areas are really, in spite of the fact of all of the rain this spring, many of these areas are severely drought-stricken. And so what's happening is the water from the rain runs off very quickly into the rivers, so the rivers flood because all of the vegetation has been cut off. So when it rains and the snow melt occurs in the spring, all that water moves very, very quickly into the rivers, and so we have flooding in the rivers but drought on the land. But back to the topic of earthquakes and nuclear power plants. Now, this is from the Wall Street Journal, July 19th, Tuesday, and the issue is regarding earthquake risk. This is on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And I just want to read this quickly. They talk about when an earthquake happened and devastated Japan, and by the way, we're finding out more and more that the earthquake really did not devastate Japan. Japan was devastated by a man-made event. The nuclear reactors in Japan that had damage were damaged by explosions or some other mechanism. Some were damaged by the tsunami, which was also man-made. There's little doubt about this anymore. But it says in this article in the Wall Street Journal that the U.S. regulators quickly are reassuring the American public that the reactors were built to withstand the expected severity of earthquakes in their areas. Privately, however, internal emails from March show staffers at the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission fretted about the public attention on the potential earthquake vulnerability of some U.S. plants. Since 2005, the agency has been working on a study of seismic hazards that is far from complete, but showed good reason to worry about two dozen reactors. These are United States nuclear reactors in potential earthquake zones. It says, although the west of the United States gets most of the earthquakes, the biggest new concern is regarding plants in the areas of the Midwest and east that have been hit by powerful earthquakes in the distant past and could be slammed again. The question is, should the U.S. regulators grapple with the issue of funding upgrades to these nuclear power plants that they might be hit by an earthquake? They're being licensed far into the future. I covered that issue on a number of shows ago. But as you might expect, the industry, the nuclear industry, would have to take money out of profits or raise rates, and none of this is deemed to be positive in terms of the industry. So you can be assured that our nuclear regulators will opt for, first of all, misinforming the public, and second of all, taking a chance on your health and well-being. And I just want to mention here, part of my show tonight, I'll be talking about what is known as the Oglala Reservoir in Nebraska. It runs from South Dakota, southern South Dakota, through Nebraska, eastern Wyoming, parts of eastern Colorado, south through Kansas, parts of northwestern Oklahoma, and through the panhandle of Texas. It's a shallow basin underwater reservoir that provides water for much of that area. 82% of the people that live in this area get their water, their drinking water and water for their house, from the Oglala Reservoir. And about a third of the crops raised in the United States are raised with direct spraying, irrigation, the water coming out of that reservoir. There's a little bit of a problem. The reservoir is fairly deep in the central Nebraska areas, but very sparse and shallow in many of the other areas where this extensive reservoir of water lies. But the problem is, people are pumping on this all over, and the issue is, in the outlying areas, this reservoir could go dry relatively soon. It's one of those unspoken dilemmas that the country faces, managing the water in that region. And one might think, well, gee, it rained a lot this year. Shouldn't that have been replenished? And the answer is actually no. That the reason being that the reservoir itself sits under a layer of shale rock, and also the because of cutting down all the forests and the trees in that area, and taking up all of the sod, which normally would have absorbed much of the rainwater. In other words, we would not be having the great floods we see today if all of the prairie were in the state it was in originally. Remember that farmlands where the corn is growing, or soybeans, basically it's like powdered dirt. There's no more goodness to the soil. Where the ranches are, the ranchers have kept the grazing land, and so that land absorbs the water and is very natural, much in its original condition. So basically the land that's been used for strictly for agriculture is completely depleted. There's no way to hold water there, and the water runs off very quickly. So the Oglala Reservoir is not being replenished. Some estimates state that it will be completely dry in 25 years. So when you drive through this area, you see miles, hundreds of miles of beautiful looking corn, but in the middle of every cornfield is a big spray a spray unit to spray all of the crops with water. That water comes from the underground Oglala Reservoir. First of all, before getting into this topic a little more in a little more detail, and some people might have a question about what does this have to do with Planet X? Well, actually, there's quite a few issues related to this, related to the survivability of our planet and our people. Say there is a major event, whether it's remember that a Planet X event may not be as devastating as it was in the past. it may not be an extinction level event. I'm not sure when this might happen again. But in the future, we can pretty much be guaranteed that someday in some a year, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 100,000 years, at some point, Earth will be devastated again by incoming large comets. So at any rate, the point is, how could people in that time frame, how could they survive? Well, if all of the land is depleted, and the only type of crops that are being grown are hybrid GMO, genetically modified crops that depend on ammonia fertilizers, the crops look wonderful, but there's no food value there. The corn grows big and tall, and the ears are big and perfect, but there's no food value in the food. And besides, if you'll find out that most of this, the vast majority of this corn is not fit for human consumption. In other words, you couldn't eat it. One of the points I'm going to make later on is that the topic came up. I was a guest on a radio show out of Chicago. I'm a regular guest with a guy named James Jancic. And we were talking about if people could go to the feed store and get animal feed and eat it. And I said, no, you cannot do that. It'll kill you. The grain and the seed, the feed that you get at the grain store for animals is sprayed with chemicals, and the animals will not die, but you will. It's not fit for human consumption, and it's stamped right on the bag. So you cannot eat the food and the grain, 99.9% of it, that's grown in this country. So you see these wonderful fields, and you think, wow, this is tremendous, but really, the food is not fit for human consumption. You cannot eat it. It will actually kill you. So at any rate, first of all, I'm going to also talk about the sun. This past week, we had a fairly significant but still not tremendous solar flare on the 15th. So what's going on with the weather? We have a couple tropical storms, nothing major. Most of the two tropical storms in the Atlantic are moving north and easterly, not affecting land. So we're early in the season, only in the kind of mid-July here, in the beginning of the tropical storm season. But on land, just let's take a review of this year. Winter, we had the coldest, most horrific winter on record, bar none. It set records upon records upon records in all different factors of weather. We headed into spring, and this spring 2011 set all the records, reset all the records for tornadoes and seasonal wind damage in all parts of the United States. In other words, we had the most costly, damaging tornado season on record. Now we come into summer, and we're breaking records yesterday. 55 records, heat records, were broken across the country, and 60 records were tied. So that's about 2% of all records that have ever been put in the record books regarding temperatures and weather were broken yesterday. And this isn't, now let me explain something. For one day for this to happen is not unusual. That could be, we could find days in the past when this has happened in years gone by. The problem is, it's not ending. This is not ending. We have also record extension of high temperatures. Now, what's going on? Is this global warming? What exactly is going on? Is the sun changing energy output? Well, for the past couple weeks, we have had a weather system bringing warm weather from the south. You couple that with clear days and 16 hours of sunlight, and yeah, we're going to have some very severe hot weather. But now I want to mention that regarding weather, regarding measuring the solar output, NASA has been administered with the the requirement to measure the solar output. That's across the entire spectrum. They're supposed to measure the solar output, how much heat is coming out in all the different wavelengths of light. And at last report, they were basically unsuccessful in doing this, unsuccessful at setting up standards. So we really don't know. We really don't know what's going on with the sun. Is it variable? Is the solar output variable? Well, we already know that it is. We watched the solar wind active this past spring. We had tremendous winds all coming out of the east, very strange weather patterns coupled with very severe wind patterns. So a lot of things going on like this. And by the way, just want to reiterate that, and I think the issue of this comet Elenin phenomenon is pretty much the nails have all been put in the coffin, that there's nothing to this. But I just want to reiterate, because there are still traces of this misinformation floating around on the internet, on YouTube videos, emails floating around, there is no issue with a small comet, alleged small comet called Comet Elenin. Now, just imagine if this were some kind of large comet damaging, large enough to do damage to Earth, it would be extremely visible to the naked eye. I have yet to be able to find this comet with a telescope. There are no photos of this by amateurs or professionals on the internet. There's some quacks that have put up some pictures that looked like they were mistaken in what they were putting up. But other than that, I've yet to see any photographs of this alleged comet. So it might be an experiment just to see how vulnerable the public is. If you receive emails or anything like that regarding Comet Elenin, or you see any other information, as I say, there's a lot of quackery going on regarding this. And so just understand that there is no issue with Comet Elenin. It's not causing what we're seeing today. It did not cause the Japanese earthquake. Okay, I don't want to waste time on that, but just it's good to keep people on their toes. But the issue with that is that there's a lot of misinformation. The real question is, why is the disinformation crew spending so much time and effort on a non-issue? That's the real issue. Why are they? What are they about to cover up? What are they covering up using this Comet Elenin story? That's the real question. Okay, so just going through the situation here. As I saw it, as I said, I did a tour of the central United States, and I saw drought. Everybody's thinking, gee, there's flooding in that area, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska. But I saw lakes dried up. I saw one little teeny pond on a farm with a horse laying in it trying to garner a little bit of coolness or a little bit of cooling effect from where a pond used to be. So one has to ask, well, how can this be? We had some of the worst flooding in history this spring. Well, as I said, that water runs very quickly off the land into the rivers, and so we can expect continual flooding in the future. Anytime there's a bit of snow melt or rain that goes along with the snow melt, we can expect flooding. It's common in Minnesota, northwestern Minnesota. There's an area called the Red River Valley. And that was once a wooded area, also grasslands surrounding the river. And that was all turned into plowed fields for potato farming. And so every spring now, it floods. The rains and the snow melt move very quickly and move to the river, and so it floods. And there's no control of this. Maybe someday this area will grow back, but it's a typical example of lack of management in an overall sense. Somebody on top saying, you can't do this. You cannot plow your land up. You have to leave the crops in the land. You can't plow it till next spring. Farmers say it's a conflict of interest in use of land and resources. It's like any other use of resources. there are groups of people that can profit or make a living off the land. Their use of the land damages other people in who are trying to use other parts of the land. And so the short story, I guess, is that the United States is just becoming overpopulated and that the land usage is becoming overutilized. Looking, as I said, with the corn crop, it's amazing. Now, a number of weeks ago, early in the spring, I challenged people to send me any crops, any place, that were knee-high by the 4th of July. And a couple of people sent these in, but clearly these were areas where there was irrigation. The use of water, underground water, to pump and to cause the crops to grow. So you will see this. Oklahoma right now, tremendously dry, parched, and see, Oklahoma is beyond the reach of the Oglala Reservoir. They don't have the underground water to pump and irrigate the crops. So if the central states of Nebraska, Kansas, and eastern Colorado, eastern Wyoming, if they didn't have the Oglala Reservoir, there would not be any crops in those areas. It's as simple as that. About 30% of the United States crop would simply not grow anymore. So that leads us to a dilemma. One of the main questions is, how long will the Oglala Reservoir sustain crops? And in some of the main areas in Nebraska, it might sustain them for quite some time. The point is that as they pump a lot of water out, and this is what I'm saying, certain areas affect other areas, it will dry up other areas, like, say, in Kansas, where the Oglala Reservoir is not as thick, or Oklahoma or northern Texas. These places are going to dry up much sooner. So the water pumping is just constant in Nebraska. But that's going to affect Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, Colorado, and Wyoming that sit on the far reaches of the Oglala Reservoir. So some estimate that the entire Oglala Reservoir will dry up within 25 years. But the point is that some of the outlying areas, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Wyoming, and eastern Colorado, may dry up in 5 years or less. There are probably some areas right now that are hitting the bottom of the barrel, so to speak. And this would affect cattle ranchers. This would affect other areas. So when you see Nebraska with this constant spraying going on every day to make the corn crops grow, remember that corn is one of the most water-hungry plants around. And what do we use the corn for? Well, it's used to feed the cattle. That's one thing. It takes, I am told, about 16 pounds of corn to produce 1 pound of beef. So is this an efficient use of corn? There's somewhat of a switch now to have grass-fed. A lot of people consider grass-fed beef to be a better product. It's a much healthier, less fat, and a much healthier product. It has a better omega-3 balance in it, and so grass-fed is supposedly better than corn-fed. So that leads us to the question. Now, one might consider, too, that some of this corn may go into bioenergy, also driving the cost of food up. So food now is competing with the energy industry in that the corn is used in some areas for producing biofuels. But let me just go through a couple of points here. The depleted soil in the states where I went, it looks like kind of a volcanic powder. That's what I would describe the land. When you look into a cornfield or a soybean field, first of all, it looks very rich, and the plants all the same size, everything very orderly, very, very healthy looking. But when you look at the ground inside the field, inside the cornfield or the soybean field, there's nothing growing there. Not a thing. Nothing. Not a weed, not an errant plant, only the seeds that were planted there for the purpose of farming, are only those seeds are growing. And from a farming perspective, this might be seen as good. But the problem is that this kind of farming is not sustainable. It'll work this year, it may work next year, but if there's an infrastructure problem, say we get hit by a solar storm and the infrastructure goes out, say that the process of producing the fertilizers from petroleum, say that those are no longer viable, say that the ability of Monsanto, Cargill to produce the large quantities of seed necessary to plant entire states with corn, say that that whole system breaks down, or say that we have a volcano go off where we have a bit of cooling around the earth for a season, all of this corn will go away in one season and it will never come back. So we're teetering on the brink of extinction because our farming methods are very poor. They're unsustainable. They look good now. If you drive around these states, you see state after state of very healthy looking crops, but this can be very short lived. Let's see. As I said, this is all hybrid GMO corn, and they are somewhat resistant to severe drought, but it's just a matter of time until this system of farming comes crashing down. It's somewhat like the banking system, that it can go on and go on and go on, but there's no sustainability. In the old mechanisms of farming, I remember when I was a kid, I went out to the family farm, out to friends' farms, and you had weeds growing amongst the corn. You had to compete with that when you cut the corn, when you harvested the corn. That corn then was left until the next springtime. You did not plow the corn under, and you didn't plow the cornfield until the next spring, and you had to wait till the water had settled in into the ground and dried up a little bit. Then you could go into the field, but your soil, very deep into the soil, captured that water. That doesn't happen anymore. Now the water just runs off the top to the river, causes flooding downstream, and then you take water from underground and pump to water the plants. This system of farming just is not going to last. There's going to be a brick wall in someday. There's going to be a brick wall that this agricultural method hits, and that will simply be the end of it. So just again, the pumping of the Oglala Reservoir, providing probably 30% of the crops in the United States, it really is going to be detrimental to, I would say, the ranch lands of Wyoming, Colorado, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, and New Mexico. I forgot little New Mexico down there. It does have an extensive part in eastern New Mexico with the Oglala Reservoir. Those outlying regions, the ranchers are going to be hit very heavy. They're not going to be able to pump water anymore. And when we go back to depending on rainwater, we'll be back into the 1800s, depending on rainwater, to provide the grasslands for the cattle to grow. How do you stop the people in the really productive areas of Nebraska with the really deep sections of the Oglala Reservoir? How do you stop them from pumping daily in the cornfields to grow these tremendous corn crops and all the way into Iowa, by the way? How do you stop this so that they can preserve this resource out into the outlying areas for a longer period of time? And as I say, there's no central focus on this ability. Let's see, I already talked about the fact that you cannot eat grain from seed and supply stores. Now, I want to reiterate that. This food is not fit for human consumption. The chemicals in there will kill you. I remember when I was doing my corn study a number of years ago, I remember in the spring, I was able to purchase and I distributed worldwide some of the last organic, non-hybrid, non-GMO corn seed, the original Dent corn seed, and that went all over the world. People are still planting that. I still get reports that people have that in the family garden. They're getting the seed crop from 1 year, and as I gave in the instructions, moving that into the next planting season and saving the seeds in the manner described in the mailing that went with the seeds. So that the purpose of doing that was to preserve corn into the future. So those few people that are succeeding with that corn seed are going to preserve corn, that the genetics essence of corn, into the future. And with that little bit of seed, someday we might maintain corn into the future if there's a natural disaster. My personal belief, when I see the health of people around the world, in the United States, I see a lot of people that are overweight, their skin is very unhealthy, and it's because of eating meat that has chemicals. When you feed this grain that is littered with chemicals, when you feed it to the animal absorbs that, it goes into the meat, then people eat the meat. And the meat doesn't kill you right away, but my estimate is that in a lot of cases, the grain-fed animals will eventually cause a lot of health problems in people. The fat will contain the chemicals, and so once again, we're dealing with a system that's unsustainable. The issue dealing with the food that is grown organically, a lot of times people claim that the food they are growing is organic, but it's hybrid GMO seed. Organic is not necessarily the best. If it's non-GMO, non-hybrid, and organic, okay, now you can start talking to me about good food. But don't try and sell me organic like they're doing in the grocery store and then have it the seed or the plant stock be hybrid GMO. This is happening a lot. I've heard that the bananas in the tropical countries, the major producers of bananas, all of those bananas are hybrid GMO bananas. So this ranges out of the country, and there are no controls in the foreign countries. So you really don't know what you're getting, especially if you're buying fruit and vegetables that are imported. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about water filters. I haven't really done much in terms of discussing the products that I sell in past weeks. But for those people that still have not purchased a water filter, you don't have a gravity feed water filter in your house. Remember that if you have a power outage or infrastructure outage in your city, if you have well water or whatever, very likely you will not have that as a source of water if there's an emergency. Some people say, well, I have a water filter in the system in my house. But remember, none of that's going to work in case of emergency. But here's a thought I had this week as I filled up some 5-gallon containers. Now, in my life, I've camped, I've lived out in the rural areas, and I've done my share of carrying water. Water seems to be one of the heaviest things in the world, heavier than rocks. I swear that the water is heavier than rocks. So for those people that have balked on getting their own gravity feed water filter, here's a suggestion. Since you don't want to spend the money on a gravity feed water filter, go buy a couple 5-gallon containers, water containers, fill them up with water, and carry them around for a little while. Every day, pick them up and carry them, about 100 yards. And then determine whether you'd rather carry that around, or would you rather carry a nice stainless steel water filter around that weighs about 5 pounds, and will filter thousands and thousands of gallons of water wherever you are. So that's just a little tip. If you really want to be convinced that you should get a water filter, then, as I say, go buy a couple of 5-gallon water containers, fill them up with water, and just carry them around a little bit every day. And I think pretty soon you'll become convinced that water is carrying water around is not a good idea. And even if you can carry water around, it's probably, in a case of emergency, it's probably not going to be very good to drink. So a lot of reasons, a lot of simple reasons for getting a water filter. As you know, I sell the Dalton brand water filters on my webpage, and just amazing that we've done some calculations that, probably over the past 10 years since the Y2K scare, gravity feed water filters have been selling in the United States and in foreign countries also. But when we made an estimate of the number of people who have a gravity feed water filter for emergency, and by the way, I use mine every day. It's on my kitchen sink. If I go camping, I carry one with me. If I go on a trip, I carry one with me in my suitcase. It's something that it's the first thing I pack, no matter where I'm going, and it's something that gets used every day on the kitchen counter. It's not just for emergency. But in the 10 years or so that the heavy sales of these items has been occurring, it's amazing how few people in the United States actually have these. So at any rate, there's still a lot of people out there that don't have a gravity feed water filter. So if you don't, go to the webpage. If you know somebody that doesn't, suggest that they, like I say, get a couple of 5-gallon containers, walk around with them for a while full of water and see how good it is, how fun it is to carry water. What would you rather do? Carry 5-gallon containers of water that's probably not fit to drink anyway? Or would you rather carry around a couple of pounds of water filter that will filter thousands of gallons of water? This past week also, I had a chance to look at a couple of animal sites. These are sites of animals that died, in some cases, millions of years ago, in some cases, tens of thousands of years ago. And the one I want to be mention specifically in eastern Nebraska, there's a very interesting dinosaur. It's rather a death scene. And what happened is there was a man that was who was walking along a riverbank, and he noticed kind of a gray layer in the riverbank. And so he started digging, and he started finding dinosaur bones. Well, this dig eventually expanded, and they found a type of small dinosaur. The kind, I think they're the smaller running kind of dinosaur. But anyway, there's a whole group of them. It was like a whole flock of them. Died due to this heavy ash that fell on the area. So it dried out the animals, and they were encapsulated in this volcanic ash. So that was all well and good, but the only problem is, where on earth did the volcanic ash come from? So they started tracing it back and found that the ash veil that suffocated and covered these dinosaurs came from Wyoming, a volcano that's very near Yellowstone in Wyoming. So that's that's a good 500 to 600 miles away. This is the kind of thing that can happen, and these things have happened in the past. Who knows if that was just a volcano that happened to go off, or could that have been associated with a big Planet X type event that happened 65 million years ago? I've never personally been convinced. In fact, I'm personally convinced that the story about the dinosaurs dying due to a asteroid collision, I don't believe that at all. I never did. There are some bits of evidence. The layers of ash that sit on top of the dinosaur that era, the layers of ash very much indicate that something came from outer space. But the question is, was this an asteroid hit on the world? And as I said before, once they started discovering locations, if there was an asteroid hit, then they had to find the smoking gun. They had to find the location where the asteroid hit. And so the best place people could come up with is off of the Yucatan Peninsula in the Gulf of Mexico. But when researchers went back to study that area, when they went back to study the ecological results of and look at the species around that particular what they believe is an impact region, they found that it didn't even kill off the animals in that region. That there wasn't even a great reduction in population of the animals in that region, the dinosaur population. So the question is, what really killed off the dinosaurs? And once again, I think we come back to our good old friend, the story regarding Planet X. And then the question comes up, how many Planet X's are there? Well, there's many Planet X's, many, 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 many Planet X's around the solar system and around every star in the galaxy. NASA has made these finds. In fact, they're now stating there's at least one Planet X-type object associated with every star in the galaxy, in some cases more. These are the ones they can see. This is based on estimates of measurements they've made on stars. So the point is that more than likely, if we're an average star, we have many, many Planet X objects. What's the periodicity of the recurrence of these events? Well, first of all, not every Planet X is going to come into the inner solar system. Not every Planet X is going to come near Earth. They might have millions of years between visitations to our corner of the solar system. They might have tens of thousands of years, or they might have shorter periods of time. 9,000 years, 3,000 years, who knows? We don't know. But we do have a history going back at least about 3,500 years, and there was an event that occurred. That's when Venus came through the solar system. And it was a large comet captured by Jupiter. This is what Velikovsky described. And the Venus eventually became Venus the comet, what the Mayans called Quetzalcoatl, eventually became the planet Venus. And the way it did this, it uses the tail drag of the large comet. This is all described in my books, how the large comets can become planets. But the point is that if that object became the planet Venus, then it's no longer out there to come back and be another Planet X. So there's a lot of mistaken identity here. Some people talk about a 3,600-year orbit of Planet X. That most likely is being confused with the Venus event in modern interpretations. Velikovsky didn't make the mistake. He very much identified it as the Venus event. But Velikovsky also never talked about recurring events or Planet X or other civilizations that saw these events many times in the past. He just concentrated on the Venus event, and that was quite a valuable contribution to science, identifying all the cultures that actually witnessed that event so that we have good information. The Colbrun is something that came along quite a bit after it was made public, quite a bit after Velikovsky died, but I'm sure he would have been very interested in seeing the Colbrun. By the way, the Colbrun, spelled K-O-L-B-R-I-N, the only legitimate place to find that is on the ChaldeanTrust.org website, and I believe it's at Goody's Bookstore in Australia. But my webpage, jmccsci.com, gives reference to that. Make sure you don't buy the one. Just beware of the copycat versions on the internet using that name. They are not the Colbrun. There are a lot of misinformation in those books and some clowns running around claiming they have written that book when it's not the case at all. So at any rate, make sure if you can get the Colburn. It's another great example of information coming from the past, information regarding the true history of man and earth. And it very clearly shows that man had some very tough times when these objects came through the solar system, and they succeeded. And not all the times that we've had events like this, not in every case, have the species succeeded in living through. There have been a number of mass extinctions. So, just in summary, for example, the issue of the Nebraska cornfields, what does this have to do with Planet X? Well, it just seems that man, whether it's intentional or not, is headed on the brink of natural disaster, so that when, say, there was a natural disaster, man would be far less able to take care of himself because of the farming methods that they're using today. They're far less able to take care of themselves because of the GMO hybrid agricultural methods. So say that we had real agriculture that would allow farmers to keep their own seeds on a local basis, there would be some hope, if the natural disasters were not too severe, that man could recover. Now, the way farming is, there is no hope, because there'd be a break in the seed production chain. The land is completely depleted. Probably 50% of the United States land area is completely depleted of any nutrients. So the only way crops are going to grow there is with artificial fertilizers, and with the types of seed that go along with that fertilizer. So what does this have to do with Planet X? If there's a Planet X event, man, as we see it today, the vast populations of man on planet Earth, would simply not last long. And even if you could go out and say it happened in September of or the fall, October of the year, when the great harvest is going on, you couldn't even eat all of the food that is coming out of the harvest, because it's not fit for human consumption. So, and in an event like that, many animals would die. Some of the bigger animals, like cows, just wouldn't make it through, because they depend so much on man and so much on very special methods for keeping the cow populations healthy. So the cow population, the larger animals, probably wouldn't make it through. So where does that leave man in case of a natural disaster, especially something like a Planet X type event that would be worldwide? Well, the end result is that the vast majority of people simply would not be able to make it through. They wouldn't have food. They wouldn't have clean water. I want to talk a little bit about the nuclear power plant issue in Nebraska. The situation, as in my opinion, is that we should be completely off of nuclear power. As I said at the beginning of the show, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is simply owned and operated by the nuclear industry. But apart from earthquakes, say that I was kind of shocked when I saw this earthquake article. What they really don't mention is there are other types of natural disasters. The nuclear power plants of today are running on fuel that was never meant to be run in these reactors. It would be like running a Ford Escort on nitroglycerin, race car fuel. These reactors burn up much faster, and the fuel, after being spent, is really very hot, so it has to be cooled. And so herein lies the problem. If they stop cooling these nuclear waste facilities, then, and a lot of this is being stored on the sites, like, for example, the one in Omaha, the two nuclear power plants near Omaha have cooling facilities to cool the nuclear waste. Well, if that's the situation, then and the power goes off for any length of time, as happened here in the last couple of weeks, and those containers start melting down, literally melting down, now all of a sudden you have the potential to contaminate the one main source of water for the entire central section of the country, which is the Oglala Reservoir. Omaha sits on the very eastern edge of the Oglala Reservoir. So the end result is that should you put a nuclear reactor on an earthquake zone, on an earthquake fault? And the answer is, of course not. But would you put a nuclear reactor on top of the Oglala Reservoir? What a ridiculous thing to do. And then start using fuel that has to be cooled. In other words, for the next million years, they have to provide cooling to those storage tanks that store the wasted nuclear, rods. That has to be cooled indefinitely into the future. So at some point, there will probably be a failure, and that will contaminate the entire central portion. Once it gets into that groundwater, it'll spread very quickly and contaminate probably the entire central United States water supply. And if they had to depend on rainwater, most of those areas simply would not make it. So a tremendous amount of conflict going on in the management of this country, and no end in sight. We have a Congress that has no idea what to do. They're doing all kinds of things that were never meant. They don't know how to balance a budget. They're spending far into the future. And just an anecdote here, the government of Minnesota just recently got going again, apparently. It's going to start. And I did want to mention something that related to World War II. And this is actually very scary. While the legislature was out and the state of Minnesota was shut down, apparently there was a lot of legislation passed that will affect how state workers perform their jobs and the type of things they do. Remember that when these people, the ones that do get to go back to work, when they go back to work, they will do anything to keep their job. So if there are laws that are against constitutional rights or freedom of whatever, these people in the states will not, they won't balk at doing anything to keep their job. And this was much the case in World War II Germany, where the major excuse after World War II, many people were asked why they supported the atrocities. The most heard excuse was, "I was just doing my job." Are we headed into such an era here in the good old United States? This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And remember to visit the webpage. We do still have some food available, the freeze-dried food. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.